Before we get to the show, we're a few weeks into the Newsmatch campaign, and we need your help. As a listener of the world, you know the value of our journalism. Now is the time to step up and support it. Make a donation today at theworld.org/match to double your impact. That's theworld.org/match. Thank you. In Washington, lawmakers are back at work.
This is precisely the misconduct that the framers created a constitution, including impeachment, to protect against.
Also today, a Uyghur American has a message for Chinese authorities running re-education camps.
I really want to bring those people, especially the ones who put their hands on my mom, to the justice.
And the long reach of Brexit, a German shop sells English knickknacks, and the owner does not like the way the UK is heading.
The Union Jack used to symbolize a country oozing style and culture, whereas now I feel it stands for insularity, nationalism, and borderline racism.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to be with you. Impeachment proceedings against President Trump resume today, this time in the House Judiciary Committee. The star witness this time, the Constitution. Legal scholars debated what the framers believed about impeachment and whether Trump's behavior qualifies. Here's The World's Matthew Bell.
If civics was your favorite class in high school, or if you're a constitutional law nerd, well, Christmas came early this year. Today's hearing in the House Judiciary Committee got into the nitty-gritty on questions about how the Constitution and the Founding Fathers thought impeachment should work in American democracy. There were four scholars testifying today, and three of them were strongly in agreement with the line of thinking that's taking shape with the Democrats in the House. Their first order of business was defining terms. Noah Feldman from Harvard Law School explained the key phrase from the impeachment clause, high crimes and misdemeanors.
The words high crimes and misdemeanors refer to abuse of the office of the presidency for personal advantage or to corrupt the electoral process or to subvert the national security of the United States.
The specific crime that Democrats want to focus on here is bribery. And Stanford University's Pamela Carlin said that's a term America's founders had a clear understanding of. They based it on 18th century English common law.
What they were understanding then was the idea that when you took private benefits or when you asked for private benefits in return for an official act or somebody gave them to you to influence an official act, that was bribery.
But is Donald Trump guilty of bribery? Feldman, Carlin, and Michael Gerhardt of the University of North Carolina were all unequivocal in their testimony. They said, yes, Trump is guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors, and that's what impeachment is all about. Here's Gerhardt.
If what we're talking about is not impeachable, then nothing is impeachable. This is precisely the misconduct that the framers created a constitution, including impeachment, to protect against.
Along with his colleagues, Noah Feldman attempted to channel the framers of the Constitution. He said if they could see the evidence produced by the House Impeachment Committee so far, they would only come to one conclusion.
In my view, if the framers were aware that a president of the United States had put his personal gain and interest ahead of the national security of the United States by conditioning aid to a crucial ally that's in the midst of a war on investigations aimed at his own personal gain, they would certainly conclude that that was an abuse of the office of the presidency, and they would conclude that that conduct was impeachable under the Constitution.
But the Republicans today called into question the very legitimacy of the impeachment process as led by the majority Democrats. Doug Collins from Georgia, the ranking member on the House Judiciary Committee, called the impeachment inquiry a sham. And he said the analysis from these three legal experts was entirely off base.
In some way, insinuate on a live mic with a lot of people listening that the Founding Fathers would have found President Trump guilty is just simply malpractice in this with these facts before us. That is just simply pandering to a camera. That is simply just not right.
The Republican side had one expert testifying today. During his opening remarks, Jonathan Turley from George Washington University said he's no Trump supporter and he did not vote for Trump. Turley also did not parrot White House talking points on the Ukraine scandal. He said the president's infamous phone call on July 25th, for example, was not perfect, and that Trump's actions in the whole Ukraine story do indeed call for a serious investigation. But on the key question of Trump's behavior rising to the level of impeachable offenses, Turley was not convinced at all. He disagreed strongly with the other three constitutional law experts testifying right next to him.
There's a difference between requesting investigations and a quid pro quo. You need to stick the landing on the quid pro quo. You need to get the evidence to support it. It might be out there, I don't know, but it's not in this record. I agree with my colleagues. We've all read the record, and I just come to a different conclusion. I don't see proof of a quid pro quo, no matter what my presumptions, assumptions, or bias might be.
Turley's main criticism of the impeachment process is that it's moving too fast. Eventually, Trump might be found guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors, he said, but he argued that the evidence is not clear yet, and that making the case for impeachment should take much more time. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Lawmakers in Washington have been doing other things, not just impeachment. Yesterday, the House of Representatives passed the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act, demanding that the White House take a tougher stance opposing the mass detention of Muslim Uyghurs in western China. The bill now goes before the Senate. In response, China's government is lashing out at the U.S. China's foreign ministry says the legislation, quote, wantonly smeared China's counterterrorism and de-radicalization efforts, end quote. Uyghur activists disagree. Among them is Furkat Jawdat. He's a Uyghur American who lives and works as a software engineer in Virginia. Jawdat says the U.S. legislation will bring hope to people like his mother, who was recently detained by Chinese authorities for 15 months.
It is a huge step, especially for the people back home. We were kind of worried that they couldn't know about the bill, but actually the Chinese government did the job for us. Like, they just reported on all of their news channels, radio stations in whole China. So I hope the Uyghur people, they are listening, they are knowing what's really happening in the U.S. So it will give them at least some hope. I was trying to tell my mom, but I was scared myself too, but hopefully she will know through the Chinese government at least.
In re-education camps, is there information that's free-flowing? Do people get to watch uncensored TV? Would they even know about this?
It will be censored, but Uyghur people, they know what's really happening. I think they can pick up some signals. They can pick up some messages through those propaganda at least. I really wanted to talk to some people in the region to see what they really think, but it's impossible for us.
And why is it impossible? Is it because a lot of them are detained?
That's one reason. And the second reason is, even though I can't talk to my mom, she was detained more than 12 months in the camp and more than 3 months in the prison. So she was released because of the international pressure. I can't talk to her right now, but her cell phone is monitored by the Chinese police. And then if we touch any sensitive topics or points as in their dictionaries, she will get in trouble the next day. When I call her, I can't even say assalamu alaikum. And then we cannot say inshallah, or we cannot say mashallah, or any kind of religious words. So I just start my conversation by, hi mom, hello mom, how are you? But before that, before all this started, like the first word we said is assalamu alaikum. It's just peace be upon you.
Right. So technically she's no longer in detention, but you feel like you cannot freely speak with her, nor can she freely speak with you.
Nah, it's not really about the terrorism or extremism. It's about the eradication of identity, history, culture of one nation, one group of people.
So you're in Virginia now, but the official arm of the Chinese government has labeled you, Furkat, a terrorist because of your activism. What does that mean actually for you in your day-to-day life?
Sometimes it's scary. Sometimes it's funny. If any viewers try to speak out for their parents or family members or for their people, they all get labeled as terrorist, extremist, or separatist. But I'm not a terrorist. I'm just a regular Uyghur American. Just because my mom was locked away in more than 15 months, I just start speaking out to save her.
Why do you think your mom got caught up in all this? Do you think she was an activist of any sort? Did she make herself especially public?
No. She was a teacher before I was born, and I'm the oldest. So once she had me, she just quit her job to become a full-time mom. My father came to the U.S. in 2006, and then we all tried all the legal ways to bring her to the U.S. She's not really like a religious person, and then she doesn't wear a scarf. And then she asked me to stop calling her. I stopped, but after a couple of days, she just calls me back because she's a mother. And then she's been living by herself in an apartment. She has to wake up by herself. She has to eat by herself. She has to sleep by herself. She just couldn't take it. She missed us so much. And then she just calls us back. But she doesn't say anything. She just cries, dear. And then she told me a couple of times that she's in trouble just because of talking to us. But I talked to her many times and I told her many times that, Mom, it's not a crime to talking to your family members. But she was detained. So it's not because of what she did before. It was just because of having contact with anyone who traveled to abroad.
Farkad, if you could have an uncensored conversation with your mom, what would you say?
I really want to know what really happened to her during that 15 months. Because that was the first time and only time that in my whole life that I wasn't able to talk to her. We all know what really happened in those places, but I really want to know from my mother's mouth. And then I really want to bring those people, especially the ones who put their hands on my mom, to the justice.
Farkad Jawdat is Uyghur and a U.S. citizen who lives and works as a software engineer in Virginia. His mother spent more than a year in detention in China but still can't travel to the U.S. to rejoin her family. Farkad, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Any Brit living in Berlin has likely come across this store, Broken English. It's a shop where nostalgic expats, as well as Germans who adore British culture, head to get their fill of Marmite, shortbread, and English tea. But along came Brexit, and after 23 years, the British owner of Broken English said all the paperwork, it is just too much. All hope is not lost, though. A German Anglophile stepped in to rescue the shop. Munich-born Antje Blank bought it a few months ago.
We sell everything from the frozen sausages, pies, bacon. We have lovely jams, biscuits, all sorts of teas. And Marmite, of course. How could I forget? I'm very cross with Brexit. I think it's a shambles. I think it's monstrous stupidity, to be honest. And I find it's a very backward move and a very insular move. It has already had impact. And so far as my husband, he's an academic and he travels to the UK every week to teach. With the fall of the pound, I mean, we have had a great cut to our income. That's one of the reasons also why I decided to take on the shop, to bolster our income. But of course, Brexit threatens this shop in the sense that we won't be able to have the variety of produce we have now. It will be much more difficult to import from smaller companies. We will have to look for different distributors and probably go for Irish companies who will remain in the EU. All people coming in here talk about Brexit. The British who come here usually with a sense of slight shame and exasperation, and the Germans coming in here with complete amusement. They come in here and say, well, what's all this nonsense about? It's just this feeling of, oh, they'd all gone bonkers, but it'll be all right in the end, because they'll come to their senses. It'll be quite prophetic if we call ourselves Broken English and the UK opts for a hard Brexit. But we have not had our Union Jack out. We used to always have a Union Jack outside the shop, and some people come inside, ask why, and all we can say is we don't feel comfortable with the Union Jack any longer. The Union Jack used to symbolise a country oozing in corn and style and culture and all that, whereas now I feel the Union Jack has been hijacked by the Tory party, the Brexiters, the Farage people, and it stands for insularity, nationalism and borderline racism. We have been thinking about putting a Scottish flag up. That has been quite popular with our customers.
Antje Blank owns the Anglophile shop Broken English in Berlin. Broken English there from Marianne Faithfull. You're listening to The World. Just ahead, more British culture news. Four artists ask the prestigious Turner Prize to upend tradition. You're listening to The World. As a listener of The World, you know that our journalists bring new perspectives and insights to issues like climate change. Just this year, reporter Carolyn Beeler spent 2 months on an expedition to Antarctica studying the effects of climate change and reporting for The World. Shirin Jafari took us inside Saudi Arabia to report on the changing role of women there and barriers to those changes. Producer Daniel Offman and I traveled to Russia to meet young people who love Vladimir Putin and others who organize in opposition to him. Not every newsroom would invest in this kind of reporting, but we do. If you value in-depth, on-the-ground journalism that brings you right into the story, then step up and support it today. A gift of any size makes a difference, but if you donate $60 today, that will be doubled to $120. Just visit theworld.org/match. Thanks very much. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There is no enemies list. That's the word from NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg this week as NATO marks its 70th anniversary. No enemies, but the military alliance does keep an eye on potential threats like Russia and now China, says Stoltenberg. This week, Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping finalized a new energy deal. The two leaders announced that on a video chat. The deal is being called the Power of Siberia, a giant oil pipeline to connect the two countries. Livia Paggi specializes in political risk for GPW. That's a consulting firm in London. Olivia, what do you make of this Russia-China oil pipeline?
This pipeline really can't be understood without taking into consideration Trump's foreign policy and what it's done over the past few years to really drive China and Russia's relations and bringing them much closer together. I mean, since Trump's come into power, we've seen a rolling out of aggressive sanctions against Russia. And we've also seen simultaneously Trump driving forward a very aggressive trade war against China. And the result has been that Russia and China have really become much closer on a number of fronts. And this pipeline is a very clear example of that deepening relationship.
I know for a while political analysts were in disagreement on whether Russia and China's relationship was improving. I mean, would you say today that this oil pipeline just dismisses those disagreements?
Well, it's a complicated relationship. It's a relationship between two great powers. So it's a combination of wanting to cooperate, but also competition. We've seen a number of, you know, clear examples of where the relationship has actually materialized in practice. This is the pipeline is one example. Gas will be physically flowing from Russia to China, and it will be bypassing Europe and the West. So that's very concrete. We've also seen they started doing joint military exercises last year in Vostok. This was unheard of before for Russia and China to have such close military relationships. So these are some very concrete examples of how they've cooperated. As I said in the beginning, there's also a relationship of competition, right? China's economy is 8 times that of Russia. So China clearly has the upper hand in this dynamic, which means that Russia has, you know, much weaker negotiating power. So it's mixed, I would say.
What worries you the most about this growing Russia-China alliance? Are you worried?
Well, I think the China-Russia alliance highlights that the jury is still out on whether Trump's foreign policy can actually be effective or not. There's been some experts that highlight, you know, maybe we need an aggressive foreign policy and this is how we can get the best deal for the U.S., whereas others have been more skeptical. And when you see an alliance like this growing and they're having greater influence in the Middle East, in Africa, these are countries where traditionally the U.S. has also had influence. It makes you question what is the long-term game of Trump's foreign policy and whether it will actually bring any benefits to the U.S. or not on a global scale.
Do you think Trump's foreign policy will respond to how the Russia-China relationship evolves? And what are you going to be looking for as that moves ahead?
The most important thing I think is really worrying is to what extent Russia and China will ally themselves militarily and also in terms of disinformation and cyber attacks, because that is something that would hurt the U.S. greatly. So I think whether you see them actually materializing on that front, that's going to be the indicator of the level of threat to the U.S.
Livia Paggi with the consultancy GPW in London. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
An 18,000-year-old animal was found preserved in permafrost in Russia last summer and is helping researchers understand how it got from this to this. The specimen has been named Dorgor. DNA testing has revealed that Dorgor is, in fact, a good boy, but the jury is still out on whether he's a good dog or maybe a good wolf. With us is Dave Stanton with the Center for Paleogenetics in Stockholm. That is the lab trying to learn more about the wolf/dog. Dave told us what happened after Dorgor was first discovered.
Since that time, we've received here in Stockholm a small fragment of rib, which we extracted DNA from. And then we did some preliminary genetic analysis on it. So we were able to say that the DNA content of the sample was very good. The DNA seemed to be well preserved.
Yeah, I mean, people who've seen the photo, I mean, it's gone kind of viral. For me personally, at first glance, I thought it was a living puppy. And then you suddenly realize, no, it died 18,000 years ago. How surprising was the spectacular condition you found Dorgor in?
It's very rare to find something this well preserved. It is one of the best preserved specimens I've seen personally.
So, Dave, I don't know if you've noticed, but I've been pretty careful not to label Dorgor yet. What is Dorgor?
So we're still not sure. We did try to see if we could assign it to being a dog or a wolf, and we were unable to do that. Now, that could just be that we need to collect more data, which we're in the process of doing. But, you know, we know that dogs were domesticated from wolves. So as you go back in time towards that domestication point, things get a bit more murky and it may be harder to sort of assign things.
Is it possible that Dorgor could be neither dog nor wolf?
You know, it's possible, yeah. I mean, there's certainly at some point in the past, there must have been something that they both came from, you know, this sort of common ancestor or ancestral population or something like that. But before we sort of can say for definite one way or the other, whether it is, you know, sort of an ancestral population or definitely a dog or definitely a wolf, then, you know, we need to collect more data.
Surely, though, the discovery of Dorgor has thrown a whole bunch of new questions into your lap about the ancestral history of dogs and wolves.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we're actively looking into and have been for some time. I mean, we know that dogs were domesticated from wolves, but what we currently think is that they were domesticated from a sort of a lineage of wolf that has gone extinct. So the only way to find out more about when that domestication occurred, where it occurred, is to try and find some of these extinct populations and lineages. And, you know, that's what we do in our lab. And so we should really start to be able to sort of nail down some of these questions in a lot more detail and with a lot more confidence quite soon.
You do a lot of work, Dave, with the survival of animal species and climate change. And I guess you could argue that Dorgor was discovered in part thanks to the permafrost beginning to melt. How do you reconcile a future of exciting frozen discoveries with the clear consequences of climate change?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, like you say, the sort of thawing permafrost is throwing up a load of exciting new discoveries. I mean, I think we've got to kind of reflect on what that actually means. And I mean, I think the, you know, we need to really get an issue on this climate change problem, you know, before a lot of this permafrost is melted.
Dave Stanton, a research fellow at the Center for Paleogenetics in Stockholm. Thanks very much for telling us about Dorgor.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
So does Dorgor look more like a wolf or a puppy? Check out some pictures on our Instagram and decide for yourself. We are at PRI The World. Here's a ritual hundreds of thousands of new Americans go through each year.
I hereby declare on oath
that I absolutely...
This is very important, not just for me, for the family. My daughter, my son, my granddaughters.
Congratulations, new citizens.
But in the age of Trump, the road to citizenship is a tough one. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. The NATO summit wrapped up in England today. There were the usual joint statements and photo ops. But below the surface, there are problems. President Trump and Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau are bickering. More on that in a bit. France's president called NATO brain dead. Emmanuel Macron also blasted NATO member Turkey for attacking the Kurds in Syria. Turkey's strategic location, straddling Europe and Asia, make it a key NATO partner. And for decades, Turkey strove to become a more Western, secular nation. But under President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the country has been moving in a much different direction. Mustafa Akyol is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington.
Turkey was never a very perfect democracy, but it has a democracy that goes back even to late Ottoman Empire. And Turkey has really gone down in terms of its freedom, its rule of law dramatically in the past 5 to 6 years.
So moving away from that Western liberal democratic model, what was Erdogan's kind of strategy?
Well, he started to get closer to Russia and China as well, interestingly. These are the powers that wouldn't criticize Turkey on human rights issues, for example. Especially the rapprochement with Russia has become very significant. Turkey bought Russian missiles, which is, of course, a major issue right now between Turkey and the U.S. Turkey allowed Russia to start building a nuclear plant, which is not begin yet, but it's there as a plan for the future. Turkey also growingly looks like Russia in terms of its political system. There's a powerful president under which the whole society takes a hierarchical form. I mean, the media, universities, everybody has to follow the leader.
So in Turkey, how united or divided are Turks over this shift, over this kind of tilt toward Russia and China?
Of course, not everybody supports this. A lot of Turks are quite worried about this drag towards the East and this move away from freedom, from rule of law. We should not forget that President Erdogan enjoys a popularity, like maybe half of the population. But then there's another half, which is very much against him. And that second half is actually growing in numbers. That's why he lost, his party lost Ankara and Istanbul, two big cities in Turkey in the recent municipal elections.
Right.
And there's a chance that he himself might lose power too. So I share with many criticisms towards Erdogan today in the West, but I think neither the Western world nor Turks themselves should give up the hope that there will be a post-Erdogan Turkey and it might repair some of the damage that has been done in the past several years.
Well, I was going to ask you, how permanent is this shift? And when you say repair some of the damage, I mean, what does that mean exactly?
Well, that means restoring rule of law. In Turkey, there are thousands of people in jail for crimes, quote unquote, that would not be considered as a crime in any liberal democracy. People are persecuted because what they say about the president or the government. Turkey also lost a lot of trust in Western institutions, and that includes NATO, that includes European institutions. So there may be a post-Erdogan Turkey where a new political leadership can say, well, we had a bad time. This was a rough era for our country, but now we need national reconciliation in the first place. It's a very divided country, but we have to heal that. Plus, we can restore rule of law. We can stop jailing people for just merely being critical of the government. And we can restore our ties with Western institutions. There are political forces in Turkey who want to do that. So I think we should not give up on that chance that Turkey's current state of affairs might change for the better. If Turkey is lucky, the Erdogan era might just go down in history as just an overreaction to the century-long domination of the more secular Turks. The risk is that this overreaction may really take Turkey away totally from Western institutions and make it an ally of Russia. Mm. So that would be a bigger problem to overturn.
Mustafa Akyol, senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Diplomatic protocol, you know, the unwritten do's and don'ts on the world stage, it's pretty straightforward. Put simply, don't be a jerk. Well, apparently some world leaders at this week's NATO summit didn't get the memo. All right, it's really hard to hear there, but that's Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He was caught on camera chatting with a small group of world leaders at a Buckingham Palace reception, apparently taking some jabs at President Trump, mocking the president's meandering press conferences. You've likely seen the video of the leaders busy kibitzing. After it surfaced, Trump said, okay, no more press conferences in London.
Well, he's two-faced.
He's two-faced, Trump said about Trudeau. The president said Trudeau is just frustrated because Trump called him out over Canada's military spending for NATO.
He's not paying 2%, and he should be paying 2%. It's Canada. They have money.
As for Trudeau, he said he was not mocking Trump. He was simply talking about Trump's unscheduled press conference. Nothing wrong with that, but the men around him at Buckingham Palace, Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron, sure seemed to be amused. The Paramount Theater in Oakland, California, is an Art Deco landmark built in 1931. Bob Marley, Bruce Springsteen, Lauryn Hill have all played there. It's also where every month new American citizens take their Pledge of Allegiance. Citizenship ceremonies generally are upbeat, patriotic, and emotional events, but these days that contrasts sharply with the tough road to citizenship under the Trump administration. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, has our story starting at the Paramount.
Inside the theater, there are women in sequins, babies in dresses and tiny suits, and people holding flowers and bouquets. And if you stand around long enough, someone's going to ask you to take a group photo.
One, two, three.
As I make my way through the lobby into the auditorium, a man spots my microphone. He's tall, wearing an elegant suit, and holding a tiny American flag. As I get close, he leans in.
God bless America. God bless the American people, those lovely people. I'm very happy to be part of them. I'm very happy that my wife and my sons are going to be American citizens too.
His name is Yaunus Waldab. He's from Eritrea and gives a big wave to his wife and two young kids as they head to the balcony to watch. And things kick off with U.S. immigration officials on stage celebrating people from all over the world.
Well, let's hear it for our friends from China who are all here today.
Randy Ricks is an immigration officer with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS. He announces all 97 countries represented by people in this auditorium. And he doesn't just do it in English. He does it in Cantonese, Spanish, Hindi, French, and you can tell he really enjoys this. He's hamming it up.
One more. Why is this here for the Philippines?
Citizenship has become increasingly complicated and drawn out. For most immigrants, there's a 5-year wait just to become eligible. After that, the process used to move quickly. But since President Trump took office, the wait for citizenship has grown longer and more challenging. Eric Cohen runs the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. He remembers a time when citizenship moved far faster.
In most cases, about a 6-month wait time.
Start to finish.
Start to finish.
And now?
In some places, it goes as high as 15, and even as high as 2 years.
Now, that wait averages 10 months, but depending on where you live, it can take way longer. Eric has been working in immigration since the 80s. He calls himself a citizenship evangelist. His organization leads one of the biggest grassroots movements to get people into the citizenship process.
It's about building our democracy. And the way to have a stronger democracy is to have as many people who can participate, participate.
But participation is at risk because people applying for citizenship today might not get through the process in time for next year's election. A professor at Colorado's Metropolitan State University estimates that a minimum of 150,000 people might miss their chance to vote in 2020. Not a trivial amount considering how tight some elections can get. And there are other concerns. Researchers at Syracuse found that lawsuits over citizenship were up by 66% last year, compared to 5 years earlier. Citizenship might also get a lot more expensive. USCIS has proposed raising the application fee to more than $1,100, an 83% hike. And they want to make it tougher for low-income applicants to get fee waivers. I wanted to talk to USCIS about all this. In a written statement, they said that citizenship applications skyrocketed under Obama and that they've hired new staff and opened new offices to keep pace. But under Obama, wait times were far shorter. I had more questions, but USCIS wouldn't grant me an interview. So, back at that citizenship ceremony, I decide to see if USCIS officials here would talk. There are actually two ceremonies today. So in between them, I walk up on stage to ask some questions.
Hi, Randy Ricks.
Randy Ricks.
Joe Hamilton.
Oh, hello. Nice to meet you. Monica Campbell.
I want to know about those wait times, but no dice. They say they're not allowed to talk and questions have to go through the press contact.
Let Sharon field them.
But well, Sharon's going to pass it to D.C. and D.C. is going to resend me a statement.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I think that's where we are.
In this moment, they look like they want to talk, but they don't do it.
Nope. Yeah. Nothing? Okay. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
People like Randy Ricks, a longtime staffer at USCIS who goes out of his way to greet new citizens in their own language, that's not who's setting the tone for USCIS these days.
Let's be really clear. We are a vetting agency first, not a benefits agency.
Ken Cuccinelli runs USCIS, and recently he got a promotion. Trump named him the Acting Deputy Director of Homeland Security, which oversees USCIS and immigration enforcement like ICE and Border Patrol. Cuccinelli has become the administration's go-to voice on immigration. He supports keeping families in detention and ending birthright citizenship. Last year, speaking to Breitbart, he likened migrants at the border to invaders who should be turned back.
Literally, you don't have to keep them, no catch and release, no nothing. You just point them back across the river and let them swim for it.
Cuccinelli helped rebrand USCIS, making it more about enforcement and vetting, which seems like overkill to immigration advocates like Eric Cohen, the lawyer from the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. Eric points out that most citizenship applicants are green card holders who've been vetted before, often twice.
You're someone who's going to have your fingerprints done. It's going to go through a number of databases, including the FBI, DHS, and all sorts of other databases to check to see what sorts of ineligibility issues you might have. So you go through quite a rigorous process.
Eric and other lawyers say they're seeing people's cases re-vetted at extreme levels. In one example, he says an official checked for marriage fraud by asking to see an applicant's house key. They wanted to make sure it was identical to their spouse's.
In one case, they had a kid together. Now, I mean, who commits marriage fraud being vetted twice and have a kid together? You don't make that stuff up.
USCIS officials say they're overwhelmed with applications, and it's true. There's been a surge, but this isn't new. Applications for citizenship have jumped before, usually around elections. But previous administrations typically added muscle to process applications more quickly and bring wait times back to normal. That's not happening today. Instead, Cuccinelli moves staff away from the problem, specifically to the U.S.-Mexico border, where hundreds of officers were sent this year.
When we have a pull on our resources, like we have with the southern border crisis, it does inhibit our ability to do other things.
My dear fellow Americans, it is with great pride that I welcome you into the American family.
Back at the citizenship ceremony, on a large screen, there's a recorded message from President Trump.
This country is now your country.
This country is now your country. And what that means for lots of people here is security. Many in this auditorium are trading green cards for citizenship, and there's a lot of reason to do that. The Trump administration is making green card holders more vulnerable. Attorney General William Barr made it easier to deport legal permanent residents who commit certain crimes. It's security, one man I met here is grateful for.
My name is Alejandro Morales. I'm from Mexico City, and I feel great.
Alejandro has lived in the U.S. for 30 years. He's an entrepreneur. He ran a jewelry store here and businesses in Mexico. He says his daughter convinced him to get citizenship because she worried about him traveling back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico on a green card.
We have had a lot of troubles in this country about the immigration, you know? Yeah. So this is very important, not just for me, for the family. My daughter, my son, my granddaughters.
For Alejandro, citizenship means the freedom to travel in and out of the U.S. with less worry and less anxiety for his family. And family is a big deal at this ceremony. It's not just the people taking the oath today who will become new citizens. Their kids looking down from the balcony will get citizenship too, automatically, as long as they're under 18. That's been the law since 2000.
And now all of you should be standing. It looks as though you all are. And now you will represent one country.
As the ceremony winds down, everyone gets on their feet. They raise their right hand and recite the Oath of Allegiance.
I hereby declare on oath
that I absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince potentate state or sovereign.
It goes on for two solid minutes. The audience swears to support and defend the Constitution, to bear true faith and allegiance, to bear arms and defend the U.S., and to do so freely, without any mental reservation
or purpose of evasion.
It's taken years for many of the people here to get to this point, and it's a process that is getting longer and harder for those applying today.
Congratulations, new citizens.
The World's Monica Campbell reporting there in collaboration with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Britain's Turner Prize is one of the world's most prestigious awards in the visual arts. Only one artist can win. Edward Enninful, editor-in-chief of British Vogue, announced the winner last night.
At a time of political division in Britain and conflict in much of the world, the artists wanted to use the occasion of the Turner Prize to make a strong statement of community and solidarity.
That statement, there are four winners this year. Helen Kamek, Lawrence Abu Hamdan, Ty Shawnee, and Oscar Murillo. They wrote to the selection panel with a clear message, we all win or nobody wins. Kamek read their joint statement on stage.
This year the jury have selected a group of artists who are all engaged in forms of social or participatory practice. We believe when grouped together, such practices become incompatible with the competition format, whose tendency is to divide and to individualize.
The artists received a standing ovation at the ceremony, though some say the panel's decision to award all four artists dilutes the prize's prestige. They say not everybody can be a winner. Oscar Murillo, one of the four winners, insists that's not true.
It would undermine the seriousness of what we do as artists to pin ourselves against each other. I think the Turner Prize is alive and kicking, but somehow the prize needed to be concluded in this way.
There is one drawback of sharing the prize. The artist will have to split the prize money, more than $50,000. Still, congratulations. Respect for elders is key in many cultures, and that certainly includes Native American communities. But in Alaska, children are bucking their elders when it comes to climate change. It's another example of kids and teens becoming the most visible advocates for action. Reporter Emily Schwing has our story about how Indigenous Alaskan youth are making their voices heard at home and abroad.
I am not an environmentalist. I'm an Indigenous youth.
This fall, 17-year-old Quanna Chasing Horse Potts stood in front of the world's largest convention of Alaska Native people with a controversial request to declare a climate change emergency.
I am Indigenous, and we are not here to fight with our own people. We are here to stand together. This is a serious issue.
The scene is rare, an Indigenous teenager speaking so publicly and in defiance of her elders. She was in the center of a dimly lit arena, normally used for hockey games and roller derby competitions. Her 15-year-old best friend, Nana Ejpeter, was by her side.
I'm sure you guys all have grandchildren or nieces or nephews, and it's their futures, and it's all of our futures, and it's all of our traditions and rights and cultures to keep this land healthy and to keep our people happy.
By the end of the day, the two young women had successfully lobbied thousands of fellow Alaskan Natives to officially declare a climate change emergency and to establish a climate change task force. But the decisions drew more than 2 hours of debate. Leaders like Crawford Pocotic raised concerns about how a climate change emergency declaration might be interpreted in the future.
The environmentalists might make it sound like this is going to help our subsistence rights, when in fact it does not. They start to use that critical habitat as a way to regulate our hunting. We're seeing.
But Kodik is from Alaska's northernmost city, Utqiagvik. He doesn't want a declaration on climate change to limit things like drilling and mining that could bring money into his community.
We can't be moving on emotion only. We got to have the right balance and making sure we don't hamstring ourselves.
Alaska Native elders remember a time when they were punished for speaking out publicly. But a younger generation of Alaska Natives, including Nana Ishpeter, feel like it's their responsibility to sound the alarm on climate change.
We're realizing that our leadership we have in right now is not taking the mandatory steps to save our future, and us having to step into that position.
Young people from around the world are delivering that message right now at this year's UN Climate Summit in Madrid.
Young people in this period of history, they're no longer afraid to speak up.
Ben Charles was recently selected as an emerging leader by the Inuit Circumpolar Council, which represents indigenous people in four Arctic nations. He's in Madrid to help kids like Quanah Potts and Nana Ishpeter formulate messages to deliver to world leaders.
They're no longer afraid of policy. They're no longer afraid of government. They're no longer of speaking their mind.
Indigenous young adults from New Zealand spent at least a month fundraising to travel to the UN summit in Madrid.
Have you noticed any changes?
Well, there's been a lot of changes.
And a group of First Nations kids is also in Spain to premiere a documentary they made about how they have experienced climate change in northern Canada.
Well, I've noticed that there is less beach to walk on, and there's a lot of permafrost melting.
Ben Charles says his goal is to bring the Alaska Native perspective on climate change to the world stage. And at 35, he's trying to bridge the gap between his elders and those who will come after him.
It's really walking two worlds and knowing that the two worlds that we're walking go hand in hand.
Meanwhile, Quanah Potts and Nana Ishpeter say they want their emergency declaration to set off a chain reaction where Indigenous people collectively and across generations decide how to move forward on climate change. For The World, Emily Schwing, Fairbanks, Alaska.
That film Emily mentioned from a group of First Nations teenagers will premiere in Madrid at the UN Climate Summit this Friday. It tells the story of how climate change is impacting the coastal village of Tuktoyaktuk in Canada's Northwest Territories. Coastal erosion is eating away at the village. Homes are at risk of falling into the ocean and will have to be moved or perish. 17-year-old filmmaker Carmen Coptano wants world leaders to do more than just understand what her community is facing.
Acknowledge us and actually take action on what we should do to help this problem. Stop thinking about what the problems are going to cause, but what solutions can we make?
Coptano is one of seven teenagers who made the 20-minute film. It's called Happening to Us and was created as part of a community project that offered film training to local kids so they could tell their stories. Kids like 15-year-old Daryl Tejuk.
I want the world leaders to realize that climate change is affecting our culture back home and affecting our homes.
Just one of the urgent messages people from vulnerable regions are bringing to the UN Climate Summit in Madrid. Stay with us for more coverage of the summit this week and next here on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.